This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about getting unstuck. It really feels like a bit of a continuation from the last two episodes that we're very much kind of tracking through the year of starting off and some of the challenges of January. And now we're into February and it's looking at kind of getting unstuck. It feels like there's a nice progression, not entirely on purpose. So in this conversation, I'm talking to a wonderful new author called Lindsay, who shares experiences throughout her life where she came from a religious background that presented certain challenges in terms of who she was and getting help. I found this a really fun conversation. She's super chatty. She's very funny. She paints great pictures of things in her life. And there are just endless examples of times when she felt stuck and what she did about it. So with that all said, I'm excited to share this episode. Before doing so, I have one quote from her book, which is from her best friend recommending it. And I think not only that is the phrasing so fun, I think it gives you a good flavour for who Lindsay is. We learn best from real people who have lived some real life and done some real work. Let's look to the ones who have come through the flames, even if they still smell a little singed. This is trustworthy leadership, and that is Lindsay. Isn't that adorable? I hope my best friends would say as nice things. I think they would. With that all said, we'll get into this conversation all about getting unstuck, self-care, therapy, so many good things. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Thank you so much for having me on this podcast. My name is Lindsay Leverton, and I'm sitting here in Austin, Texas, and you're in Ireland, which just blows me away that we are worlds apart, but somehow having a podcast interview. So thank you. You know, my first memory of feeling anything that I would call now anxiety, but back then I didn't know what the word was. I just felt out of place and uncomfortable most of growing up. And then it really got worse in high school, always being anxious, being stressed out about everything. And we didn't talk about it, you know, in my family, and we didn't talk about it in the community I grew up in. If you had mental health issues, that wasn't even a phrase that we knew. If you were sad, well, then you just needed to get over it. Pick yourself up by your bootstraps and get over it. I grew up in a small West Texas town, and nobody went to counseling. Yeah, there was one counselor in pretty much our whole town, and nobody wanted to go to him because then everybody would know your business. And if people found out, oh, she's going to see Dr. So-and-so, like, oh, well, I guess they're crazy, you know? And it was this terrible stigma where you really just had to be happy. And if you weren't happy, well, you needed to figure out how to get happy. And there was no medicine. There was no, you know, I didn't know about counseling really at that age, but just kept struggling. And the worst of it was when I was in high school and I realized I was gay. And I came out to myself at 17, and I grew up in a really religious home. Like, evangelical Christianity was on the walls in my house. You know, it was everywhere. I grew up learning you can't be gay. You know, homosexuality is a sin, an abomination. So I was already an anxious kid, filled with anxiety, feeling out of place. And then I get to high school where, by the way, I graduated from a Christian high school, knowing that I had this secret. For me, it was a dark secret. I couldn't tell anybody. I was in the closet until I was 26, went into full-time ministry after college, and just got more and more anxious. And then my first memory of having clinical depression was in college. I was engaged to a wonderful Christian man. I thought, if I could just get married to a Christian man, I know I'm loyal, so I won't have an affair. And then that'll trap me in this heterosexual marriage. And maybe that'll give God time to change me to straight. I mean, I like to think I'm an intelligent person. Just totally brainwashed. Bought it hook, line, and sinker.
At that stage, yeah. You know, in college, you have this plan that I'm going to follow this predetermined path. I'm going to marry this man and maybe that'll sort things out. Was this all still internal? Did anyone else know at that point?
Nobody knew. I had started going to ex-gay counseling, ex-gay therapy, reparative therapy, so my therapist knew. But the whole point of that therapy was to find a way to either be straight, pray the gay away, or live a really lonely life full of suffering, because apparently that's what I was supposed to do because I was born liking girls.
So you know? Either find a way to, you know, fix in heavy quotations, or just be single forever.
Yeah, those were my options. Get married and just hope that you change, or find a way to deal with it. And I was told, this is the cross that you must bear. This is your struggle. And life is about struggle. So sorry that you like girls, but your life's going to kind of suck unless you are able to pray the gay away.
Yeah. And look, I want to pause on that as well, because there's something in it for the listeners. As much as on the show we're super pro-therapy, that does not mean you should go in without cynicism. Go in, find the right person for you. And if it doesn't feel right, or if it feels like something is conflicting with who you are, that's something to be examined, because, you know, there are still parts of the world, including parts of Texas, where that kind of, again, therapy in heavy quotations still exists. It's still somewhat normalized. And in the same way, things will continue moving forward. There's other ways in which we examine therapy, of like how white and straight focused so much of the history and the research around this type of work is, how much of the research has been carried out by men versus women. And there are gaps, like ADHD is one that people are very aware of, how overlooked that has been in women, because so much of the research has been based on how it shows up in men. So I just wanted to put a pin in that. I know you would never go back to a therapy like that again, but there are people that, as you've described, it can feel normal at the time.
Yeah. And it's sad that I sought her out. Like, I wanted to change. I didn't want to be, you know, depressed my whole life. I did depression, really. I knew that people got sad. I knew that my grandmother really struggled with depression and was, you know, most likely an alcoholic. I feel like most of that generation was. But in college, I remember having this very intense moment where I was watching a movie, sitting next to my fiance, the man I was engaged to in college, and on my other side was my best friend. I write about this in the book because it was this just defining moment for me. And I remember being in love with her and not being in love with him. And I fell into a deep depression. I ended up breaking off the engagement. But I got to the point where I finally realized, oh, this is depression, because I could not get out of bed. I didn't care how hard I wanted to, how much I willed myself to do it. The only reason I was able to move through that was because of my dog, Boo. And I had to get up because I had, you know, I had to let her out to potty. She was a border collie, so I had to go out and be active with her. So I always say Boo saved me through that depression. But those were hard times. I did finally go to a doctor, which, again, in my growing up, you didn't go to doctors for stuff like that. The Holy Spirit can heal you. You don't need a counselor, because God is the great counselor. I mean, literally, this was, you didn't go to therapy if you're a Christian. And so I finally went into the doctor and got a new therapist and started getting on medicine. The first medicine did not work at all. And I wanted to just throw the baby out with the bathwater. But I stuck in there, tried a different medicine, and it was really life-changing. So I'm a huge proponent, doctors, the right kind of therapist, the right type of medicine was a game changer for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting hearing you say that, because I am religious and Christian myself. And so, you know, in a different kind of way, I feel very protective. The power of it can be abused. And how organized religion can often really harm people. You know, I put a lot of that down to people and this kind of restrictive way of viewing things, when, you know, for me anyway, there's something in, you know, and this is both in my own perspective, but also in the way I was raised, there's something around people being there to support each other too.
Yes, you know, 100%. I miss a faith community, you know. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Keep going.
No, that was kind of it. That point of, you know, I don't know, maybe it's examining, You know, it's like, okay, yeah. Is this the right church for me? Because there are parts here that are really, you know, affecting who I am, or really sort of jarring with something inside of me that says this doesn't feel quite right, you know?
Right. And I'm so thankful that there are more and more churches coming up, even here in Texas, that are open and affirming. I came out in 2009, was touring full time as a contemporary Christian recording artist, worship leader, you know, speaker. Came out in 2009 and lost everything, lost my career, was kicked out of, you know, several churches, never thought I would even lead worship again or sing for that matter. And a few years ago, I started finding these churches that were open and affirming, and I've gotten to sing again. I've gotten to lead worship again. And my friends in the gay community, they're like, Lindsay, why do you still mess with any of that stuff? Why do you even fuck with church and God anymore? And every time my answer is, you know, his people, in quotes, his people acted one way and rejected me, and it was just very painful. But God, my higher power, source, love, intelligence, whatever name you want to give to the one, right? I've always had a close relationship, and people just didn't get that. And I said, well, I never felt rejected by God. In fact, when I came out, it was a long journey of reconciling my faith with my sexuality. It did not happen overnight. It took so long. But I started to question, maybe I got this whole thing wrong about God and me being gay. And I started to get curious. And it was a long road, but eventually I was able to reconcile my faith with my sexuality. And my relationship with God, my faith actually grew. I don't love a lot of the Bible because it's been used as a bludgeoning tool against me and my community, but there are some verses I do like. And one of them is, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And when I came out, I felt like I had taken the first deep breath I'd ever taken in my life. And I felt that freedom. And I tell you what, my chronic pain was dramatically improved. Depression, anxiety, ADHD, that's always been a part of my story. So that wasn't improved, but, you know, thankfully I have some good medicine for that.
No, I'm so glad to hear all that. You've highlighted there such change that came up in your life. I wouldn't imagine it was as quick as it's been described to me. So what was that like in terms of going to the doctor for the first time, working through some of that stigma of, you know, we don't do that around here, of accepting, okay, I do need this medication and therapy does have a place in my life?
I tell you what, I would not have gotten through the coming out journey without my therapist. I wasn't on any medicine at the time. I had gotten off my antidepressants, which probably wasn't the best choice. You know, I tend to get off medicine at the worst time. Like, I'm feeling better. It's like, well, okay, that's probably medicine's working. But I wasn't on any medicine, but my partner at the time got into an amazing therapist. His name is Jason. And I tell you what, he was able to walk us through so much pain every day. My partner at the time was my drummer and my tour manager. We fell in love while we were touring. Turns out she was gay too, and we really had no idea that the other was gay. I ended up marrying her, and we adopted twins from birth together. We had a really beautiful marriage, but Jason saved us. Getting the right therapist was open and affirming, gay himself. That was huge. And to be fully open in the rooms of a therapist who I trusted, who wasn't going to harm me like my first one had done, for him to look at me and just accept me and love me and not see anything weird about the fact that I was in love with a woman. And he also had faith. I felt like I was home in that room. I would go and sit on that couch. I can still remember it. And I would feel this blanket of love. Like, at least the whole world can turn against me, but I've got my partner. My parents were not supportive, but they were available and they were there for me. But knowing I'd lost everything, faith community, but to sit with this therapist and to be able to listen to him and to share with him with no filter was so healing. I can't recommend therapy enough. You're right. The right kind of therapist, the one that works with you and for you.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like there was a real intersection there where he was an example of someone that came from that religious background, mm-hmm. had parallels in terms of sexuality, and those things married together without conflict. You know, that was your example of someone that can live both. It's interesting hearing what you've described of friends of yours that would question you kind of going back towards faith. And, you know, I think there is that inclination in us to sort of return home in a certain way. However you feel about religion, we could swap in other things, like if you felt culturally rejected, there's still that yearning to kind of find acceptance where you came from. And so sometimes that is sort of finding ways to work through this or finding your new tribe within that. Or sometimes it's finding, you know, parallels of a different religion or a different cultural experience that's similar enough to yours that you find that kind of affirming acceptance.
I think what you're talking about is community. I know I couldn't have gotten through that alone. Every time I go through trauma or a tragedy or a loss, I look back and I think about who's in the room with me. Who are those people that I know if I sent them a text or I called them and said, I'm struggling, I can't get up off the floor. Or I remember one time I called my best friend Jessica and I said, girl, I am in the bathtub eating a chicken breast top of a fork. You know, I'm not taking a bath. There's no water in here. I am in the bathtub eating a chicken breast off a fork. And she just said, put the chicken breast down, get out of the bath, go outside, and just start walking. And that was such good advice, because a lot of the times that trauma gets trapped in my body. And that's just what my body does. My body has perfected the art of holding unresolved trauma and pain. And to just walk, to move my body, that has helped a lot too. Not trying to go be a CrossFit athlete, but just baby steps, walking to the mailbox. You know, I brought my exercise bike into my living room, which is an eyesore, but at least that trauma is not staying in my body.
And I don't mean to laugh, but the visual that you painted there is just so...
It's hilarious. It's intended to make you laugh. That's the other thing. I mean, humor has been so healing for my own mental illness struggles. God, laughter is so healing. You hear it's the best medicine. And I think that's been proven with science too. So laugh away, Bobby.
No, I agree. And that's something that for a long time I was sort of wary of on this podcast, because I wanted to show that we were taking things seriously and understood the gravity of these conversations. But, you know, similarly, that's been part of my experience too, that, you know, there's a particular dark humor that can come from going through things in your life. And, you know, I think often you can recognize it in other people. And so there's something sort of shared in that humor of, we can laugh about things that maybe some other people couldn't.
Right. And sometimes if I don't laugh about this, I'm going to end up back in that damn bathtub with the chicken breast. So one of my favorite daily practices, which sounds really weird to call it a practice, is listening to stand-up comedy. I love it. I listen to it when I get ready. I listen to it in the car. Laughter has been so healing. And it's not like I'm trying to laugh away the pain. I'm not attempting some spiritual bypass by laughing. It's not a toxic positivity laughter. It's I'm in the midst of the shit right now, going through it. And if I can laugh a little bit, that just gives my nervous system a little break, which is nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love stand-up comedy. I recognize what you're describing there, that there can be this inclination to watch things to distract from how we're feeling, particularly like sitcoms like Friends. That's a lot of people's happy place where they go and watch that to change their mood around. And there's absolutely a place for that. For me, it's been something with stand-up where I wonder if because it's one person presenting their life experiences, their perspective, maybe their political views, what they've been through, and doing all of that in a humorous way, it's a very kind of direct form of insight in a way that like a TV show is a kind of combination of perspectives. And so, yeah, it's great to see kind of how stand-up has evolved. And you get people like Taylor Tomlinson, where mental health is so at the forefront. Yes. And not one moment of comedy is sacrificed when she's talking about even the toughest stuff. I love it. And I agree with you. It's so fun, but also I think we can learn a lot from it. Even, you know, even if it's funny, it's like, well, we tend to joke about the things that matter. If you're going to go up on a stage and tell the same jokes day after day, it's probably stuff that's important to you that's going to be important to others.
Yep. And it's a way to heal. I mean, when I think about my passion, I love making people laugh. That is present throughout the book because I just love making people laugh. And the material is very dense, an easy read in some ways, but there's a lot of pain and trauma that is woven throughout it. But that humor piece, my secret dream in the world, Bobby, is to be a stand-up comedian. I've done a few open mics here and there, and I love it. I love my job now, so I think I'll probably retire with what I'm doing now. But maybe when I'm older, you know, I could be this 80-year-old stand-up comedian. I'm sure that would be a big hit. So we'll see.
It's fun. Something to look forward to. Yeah. So tell me, you know, in terms of the relationship you got into, you were having this experience going around touring churches, leading worship, singing, performing, and, you know, clearly getting a lot from that, you know, creatively. There was something really affirming there. And as time goes on, there's more of that conflict between the lack of feeling accepted or feeling like you can be yourself. And then it turns out someone that's been in your band this whole time is dealing with something very similar. That sounds incredible to find that. And you've had kids together and you've built this whole life. And then more recently, things have changed.
Well, actually, that was my first ex-wife. A lot of people get to say they have two. I don't have two ex-wives yet, but I'm
you're working on it.
I'm see you. If you don't laugh about it, you know, you'll just, again, end up back in the bathtub with the chicken breath. No, so my first wife, we tried our darndest to make it work. And we had a really lovely relationship. We ended up getting married. And as we got older and things changed with having kiddos, we realized that we were better friends. We were going to be the best moms if we were not married. So it was tough. Those were hard years, especially since the babies were so little. But we divorced in 2016. And that was a whole nother ball of wax getting through that. But the marriage that I am in now, we met on a dating app called Her, which is a lesbian dating app.
Yeah, I've interviewed its founder. She's so funny. You'd love her.
Yes, I love that. They featured our wedding, I think, on the app for a little bit because we met on the app. But we had our first date in 2018, and it was love at first sight. We had just a really magical relationship, honestly. We got married at the beginning of the pandemic, I think because it was this crazy story of we got married at a drive-in movie theater because our dream wedding got canceled. And so April 2020, like 90 cars came to this drive-in movie theater and our wedding ended up going viral, which it must have been a slow news week. But I mean, it was, the New York Times came to our wedding. We were in People. We were on the Today Show. It was insane, but it was so dreamy. And shortly after that, we had the lockdowns and we had three kids in the house trying to do school. I was working full time and my wife was struggling a lot with anxiety, just completely overwhelmed. And she saw a doctor, got on some medicine. I'd helped her a little bit, but toward the end of, you know, 2020, the anxiety became more severe and some really rough things happened that I can't really talk about because I'm in the midst of a divorce, but she was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. And I didn't see really any signs. I think it was a mixture of her being laid off, having, you know, these kids in the house. It was stressful. We were all trapped inside. And then she got COVID and just something changed in her brain chemistry. And she got that diagnosis in 2021. And if anyone's listening to this who has around someone with BPD, it is very challenging. And there's not medicine for it. There's very little resources for helping with that. And it just got worse and worse. And it no longer became viable or possible for me to stay in the marriage, keep myself and my kiddos. So that's why if I am talking to people now, you know, especially on podcast interview, I have never been in more pain than I am in right now, which is saying a lot because there's, you know, I know we all have pain. We all have a story, but I kind of thought I'd done all my trauma I'm good, God. I don't need any more character building. Thank you very much. We can be done for a while, right? No. And so this is the hardest season that I've been in. And I don't know how I would get through it without my sertraline, you know, great doctors, my therapists, and my community. So that's the context of why I have almost two ex-wives.
Fair. Thank you for sharing that. And side note, love to hear sertraline in a Texas accent. It's never sounded so good.
Oh, what does it normally sound like?
No, I think just the way you said.
I'm like, sertraline. Yeah, here, bless her heart. She's on sertraline. It's hilarious.
Oh, dear. I love getting to talk to guests all over the world. One of the things is certain American accents. I'm Barbie, as if there's an A in it.
Oh, that's like another... Barbie?
Barbie, that's one I notice. So talking about...
my wonderful marriage experiences. Yeah, mm-hmm. Just good track record there. Mm-hmm.
No, but it's, you know, there's something to that even, right, that we were talking about off air, that you can have these parallel stigmas. You can have stigma around mental illness. There's certain ones like BPD, which are still so misunderstood, more so than other conditions, and where a lot of the stereotypes around it are so damaging. You can have stigma around divorce, even though most marriages end in one. It's actually just like statistically more normal than staying together till one of you dies. And so I get it that it's such a tough time when these things come together and you're like, do I need any more learning? I thought I was good.
No. Yeah. I just want a little break, like just a year of small T trauma. Not any big T trauma, you know, but who knows? We'll see. Life will keep on lifing. That's what I say. Life will keep on lifing. And we can either, you know, bitch about it, or we can feel it all and move through it and learn from it and carry that into the next shit that life throws at us.
Absolutely. And so as you navigate this time with challenges, with, you know, the divorce still being ongoing, what sort of things do you do for your mental health day to day?
That's a really good question. I'm hesitant to admit this because it's probably not healthy, but the Real Housewives of all the cities have been just so helpful, because watching them really makes me feel like maybe I don't have it too bad. At least I'm not, you know, as animated as these women. No, that's more of probably an escape. So it's probably not very healthy.
But I think there is something to get in context, even if it's from silly reality TV, to be like, well, look, my life could be more dramatic. I don't watch The Housewives, but I hear a lot of them seem to be nearly going to prison every season. So big stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Big, big stuff. Never been to prison. Well, I used to go to prisons to sing, but I've never physically been incarcerated. Yeah. A lot of housewives in jail. But for me, it's staying on top of the basic needs. And this may sound really elementary, but getting enough sleep, like that's been huge for me, because I'm a night owl. I'm an artist and I could do my best work, you know, between the hours of 12 and 2 a.m. But getting enough sleep has been really important. Water. I mean, this is low hanging fruit, people, but sometimes I need to go back to the basics. Walking, moving my body has been really huge. And spending time with people who make me feel loved and accepted, and laughing with those people. And then I think, you know, meditation, when I remember to do it, mindfulness, trying to be present in every moment, that's been really healing. I'm trying not to go too far into the future or the past. As my mentor says, if you're standing with one foot in the past and one foot in the future, you're just pissing on the present. And so I love that mental picture.
Another Texasism, I'm sure. No
so
subtlety.
There's so many. But those are just a few things that help me get centered. And I, you know, prayer, I'm not just praying all the time, but there's been so many moments in the past 6 months, especially, where my prayers are real simple. Help. Thank you. Help. What the F? And then help and thank you again. Those are pretty much my prayers.
Yeah. And look, I really respect what you said there about having this back to basics attitude, because we get to these points in our life where we're dying out for an easy answer. And sometimes the easy answer is looking after ourselves, which doesn't feel easy when we're struggling. when maybe affecting our self-esteem, making it difficult for us to look after ourselves because we're so busy treading water. Yet it's important stuff. If you ever need sleep, it's at a time when you're going through big challenges.
I mean, a lot of the times practicing self-care and mindfulness and remembering to put the oxygen mask on yourself first, that feels a little bit like trying to change a flat tire while you're driving 75 miles on the highway. It's like, how am I supposed to move my body if I don't want to go anywhere or do anything? How am I supposed to get sleep if right as I fall asleep, my anxious brain is up telling me all the things that I did wrong that day? You know, but it's one of those things where self-care has become this commodity and it's been so monetized. And we think of, oh, a bubble bath and a massage. Those things are great. But sometimes it's just looking in the mirror and instead of listening to that voice that says, you piece of shit, you combat that and you tell yourself a truer narrative. Like, I'm doing okay. I'm here. I'm putting one foot in front of the other. Life is happening for me, not to me. I say that 8,000 times a day. And realizing that self-care, like we've heard, it's not selfish. It is not self-centered. To me, it is essential. If I am pouring out of an empty cup, I'm going to get to the end of that. And then what am I going to give my kids? What am I going to give my clients in my day job? What am I going to give myself? So doing a lot of that internal work, making sure that I'm not giving out of an empty space. And the people that I specifically had in mind when writing this book is overwhelmed moms. I mean, it resonates with other people, but a lot of the times these overwhelmed full-time working moms trying to do your job and cook and clean and do all the things. It's like, how do you prioritize yourself when you don't have any time for yourself? Well, there's no magic answer. No one's coming to save us. We have to set aside that time or we're not going to make it. We're going to burn out. We're going to stay stuck, which is the worst place to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Carving out that space, it's so important. And I want to double down on what you said about self-care. It is not a product. It is not a task. Sometimes self-care is going to bed early. Sometimes self-care is not doing anything that morning. It's the absence of tasks. Yes. It's the absence of needing to spend money and do all the things and put it on Instagram.
I've got one downstairs, two upstairs.
I love that you're like, mom's trying to do it all. And then the dog's coming right on cue being like, what? You're not feeling overwhelmed? Here we are.
Yeah, exactly. I know. And they're so needy. These dogs are so needy and all their needs. And, you know, I need to move my body and I need to eat. You know what? I will get to you.
Well, they look, they don't have any trouble prioritizing their own needs. Maybe there's something there.
No. Right? They just sleep all day. We feed them and pick up their crap. Anyways, I think that it's like who saved who? You see those bumper stickers. I'm like, who is controlling whose life? It's not the owner, I guarantee you.
Yeah, I had that in the pandemic where we became just a nuisance to my cat because she wasn't used to me and my flatmate being there all the time. And it got to the point where we started, like, if she was on the sofa, we wouldn't move her because we felt bad. And then at a certain point, you're like, we're the adults. We're meant to be in charge. If I want to sit on the sofa, she's going to have to deal with that.
Oh, yeah. My dogs, I could just imagine them having a conversation, you know, in the beginning of COVID. Just like, why is she still here? Like, is she on house arrest? You know, they had no idea there was a global pandemic. But like, did she finally get arrested for, you know, not letting us out more than she does? And I could just imagine. This is what my brain does, Bobby. This is the neurodivergent brain where I imagine fake conversations that my dogs are having about me. That's very strange.
And look, if that isn't the pandemic experience summed up, on that note, we'll start wrapping up. So if people want to find the book, find more about your work, where do they go?
Yes, social media stuff. That's the best way to keep in touch with me and sign up, throw your email in there. And I don't spam people. I just keep you updated on things like this podcast that I've been on. I'm doing an interview series this year with 12 incredible women where I'm releasing one a month. But I just hope everyone will get the book. Somehow we hit number one on the new releases for Amazon bestseller last week, which was really cool. And, you know, just for those of you who are listening, it's more of an experience. It's not just a book. So between each chapter, I've created adult coloring book pages so that the reader can kind of doodle and let what they've just read settle a bit before going on to the next chapter. There's also a QR code in each chapter that leads to one of my original songs, you know, that aligns with whatever the content is in the chapter. So it's basically a book and an album and a coloring book all in one. So enjoy the experience. But thank you, Bobby, so much for having me on. Thank you again for what you're doing. It's so important. And I can't wait to keep listening to your podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.